Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, November 17th. It has been a year since a bird sanctuary on Oahu's North Shore had to cull its flock due to avian flu. We now have the first cases this year, the first on Maui. We hear from a small business about the challenges of staying in business between recovering from the pandemic to on-again, off-again tariffs to the rising minimum wage. We hear about a charter school on Kauai, which just got underway this fall and fills a void on the Garden Isle. And we celebrate 125 years since the arrival of Okinawans in Hawaii. We take a closer look at their music. Plus, we take you out on the water for the relaunch for a historic Koa canoe, the oldest Hawaiian racing canoe commissioned by Prince Kuhio. It's a symbol of pride in our paddling community. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It was in November of last year that Susan Wilkinson's nightmare began. Her duck Hector was one of the first casualties of the avian flu, the first case of the disease ever detected in the islands. Wilkinson operated Susie's Duck Sanctuary, a nonprofit dedicated to the rescue and rehabilitation of birds. After the detection, the entire flock in her backyard operation in Waihewa had to be destroyed. We caught up with Susan Wilkinson this morning, who reflected that her backyard was ground zero, and she thought about what she called a horrific year.
It's been a year of survival and healing and grieving, but to go with that has been an insane amount of support from friends, family, and complete strangers who just appreciate the kindness I was trying to share with animals and just them supporting. So with all the darkness, there's definitely been a lot of light as well, so I can't not appreciate that.
Well, you had a backyard flock, and you were helping to rescue ducklings, which I think I hear in the background. But
a little bit of chirping, a little peeping.
Yeah, but so much has happened. You had to put down your flock, and those were a lot of birds.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. And whether they were sick or not, it didn't matter at that point. The state euthanized all of them.
You have since regrouped. You took a break just for your mental health after that happened, and you're slowly getting back on your feet. But what's the message that you want to get out here as we are in the start of this season again, and we are seeing more positive cases in our ducks and birds?
I think the biggest one is that now that we know it officially can reach Hawaii, it's just a matter of being proactive now. I mean, we should have been all along, but it just seemed out of reach a little, but now it's definitely a thing. And I think instead of being fearful, the message I want people to take in is that you just have a plan, have a quarantine plan, have it set up, and no one can tell you when some places in some countries, like they'll say you have to go on lockdown now. We don't have that here. So I think you should know when it feels right for you to implement those quarantine procedures that you're putting together.
You had a crisis on your hands and you weren't sure how to deal with it because it was moving so fast. And
we didn't know what it was. We thought it was like a groundwater poisoning because it was the rainy season and it was washing down the property. Yeah, it was crazy. So we had no idea in a million years that it was avian flu.
Right, because the thinking back then was the chances of something popping up is remote. It's very low. But you were ground zero.
Yeah.
Refresh our memories again. What were the first animals that got sick?
It was immediately ducks and the doves. There were some wild of the little tiny mountain doves that were on property. And they just kept passing away multiple a day. And in a week, over the course of a week, we lost over 20 ducks plus goose and 13 of those doves.
And how many birds did you have on your property?
Around 100.
Wow.
Because they were all rescues. They weren't just a collection of things that I was gathering. These were all rescues that had been dumped or injured or abandoned. And so we were a 501c3 nonprofit rescue sanctuary. So we were in the process of healing and rehoming and trying to rehab them. So some were weaker than others, but some were not. And so it wiped them out so fast. And then it stopped, and then it was done. But at that point, we still didn't know what it was. And then the diagnosis came through, and then the state came through.
Yeah, and you were working with the state agriculture department, is that correct?
Yeah, the state veterinary office within the ag department.
And then I understand that USDA has been testing a number of ducks and birds this year. And once the season ended and things calmed down, this was, I think the one in October in Manoa was the first case, again, that tested positive.
Right. It's kind of like you hear it in the news about the cruise ships when they end up with norovirus and the viruses that go around the cruise ships in the winter. For some reason, the heat doesn't stop it, but it definitely lessens it. But the cold weather allows it to grow and breed much quicker. And then the winter, this time of year, is also migration season. So the birds are moving a lot. And so you've got the ones that are coming. I think one of the ones they found that they tested positive was not a native one here at all. I mean, not even native, but not even a normal one here. It was one that had migrated in. So that's how it's coming onto island.
Yeah. And if I recall, last year they detected something in the wastewater.
Yeah. I have no idea what that's about. So they had already started testing mine when that report came out. So when that report came out, it was devastating. Like that was the pre-confirmation of what we were dealing with.
And so talk about the time frame when you first started to see these ducks get sick and the birds, the doves get sick, and when you had to put them all down.
So they started passing. We had about a week of deaths. And a couple days later, the state came over and killed everything and euthanized the rest of them. So it was under 2 weeks, the whole process, maybe about 10 days, 11 days.
And you talked about the importance of having a plan. And what does your plan involve now, knowing what you went through and maybe helping other organizations like yourself, rescue groups, deal with a crisis?
So the biggest thing is, everyone keeps saying it, you know, if you're doing rescue at all or anything that comes in, unless you completely lock down, have a completely inaccessible shelter from any other outside bird coming in, your flock is susceptible. So you have to have the ability to close them down 100%. So even netting is good, fencing is good, but if the small birds can get through it, you're still going to be at risk. One of the things that there have been some studies on in the UK and in the US, private independent studies, is it's called Chinese skull root or biclin. It's a powder, it's an antiviral, and it has been helping a lot. It's been helping. It's a preventative measure that people are putting into the, like it's a powder that you put into the food of your flock, and it's helping them to build up some strength against a virus coming through. Is it 100% perfect? No, there's not enough scientific studies on it, but a lot of folks who have had issues in the past are not having issues. And the one in the UK actually had it reversing some of the symptoms, the blindness that they start getting and some of those symptoms. So again, it's feeling of not just being completely helpless. It's at least something you can be doing that has had positive effects. There are different disinfectant sprays you can be doing, but the quarantine, the big quarantine, is having a lockdown facility for your flock. That means bringing them indoors. Like if you have a carport, find a way to shut it down so that you can bring them in there, or building up a greenhouse or some kind of a structure on your property that you can bring them all into so that there's no exposure at all for multiple weeks, just to keep them safe. But having that plan and being able to do it now versus when it's too late, again, it's something you can be proactive doing instead of reacting at the last minute or it's too late.
Yeah, you want to spare anyone the trauma that you went through.
Oh, yeah. I can't even explain the trauma of what I went through, besides just them passing away, the actual losing of everything. I've actually moved off of that property since. I can't even be on the property anymore.
Yeah, and you were planning a trip. You had to postpone a trip to deal with this crisis. So you have since relocated, and you are helping, though, to rehome and rescue.
Yep, I did. The need was really great. I didn't have the intent. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I could handle it or not. I still debate whether it was the right decision, but they give me a reason to get up in the morning to help somebody else. And the need was so great. Every time I get a call, it's, we've called five places and nobody can help us. You're the only one who can. And it's a lot of pressure, but I at least I'm doing something. I'm able to do something. And so that gives me a better purpose. So we're trying really hard to educate. We're focusing a lot on education and outreach this year. So if you'd like us to come and speak to schools, community centers, I think a lot of people who live in townhomes, condos, really need the education as well, because there's a lot of feeding of the ducks on their properties, which is great, but it just has to be in accordance with the rules of the apartment, but then work together with them, but then also learning what it can or can't do depending on if avian flu is affecting your flock, even just your outside natural flock. But we're just trying to help educate folks and just make it a healthy environment for everybody.
Well, this situation, it was just a disaster. And when we were chatting this weekend, and this weekend marked, I think, a year since all this came down. I remember being caught up on the North Shore during the tsunami alert and not knowing, because that's not my hood, right? I was like, oh gosh, where do I go? But in your situation too, where you might have some ducks or ducklings and having to move them to get to higher ground, if that's the case.
I think a lot of it really comes down to pet and animal ownership. If you have, you've taken on the responsibility of another life form, like a dog, a cat, ducks, anything, then you need to be responsible of how to take care of them. Ourselves, a little bit easier. We can go, all right, like grab your good stuff and go. But you need to have a plan. I didn't. I wasn't ready. I am now. I know exactly how to evacuate. And everyone's, oh, they're ducks. They can fly. They can swim. Water won't bother them. But a lot of them are recovering. A lot of them were very young. A lot of them were domestic breeds that can't even fly. People don't know that some ducks can't fly. Their bodies are too big, their wings are too small, and they are flightless. Again, it's just the awareness of and making plans for those kind of things. I know just as simple as the fire department used to give out, and I think some organizations still do stickers for your window of your house somehow to allow the fire department to know if you have pets inside, if there's a fire, they know to look for them. Just simple things like that, that you're making an effort to help protect members of your family that, you know, may have feathers or fur.
Well, we thank you for sharing your experience and getting the word out for people to have a plan. We don't want a repeat of what we saw last fall.
No, I don't want anyone to ever go through that. This has been crazy. I'm impressed that I'm not crying, so I'm good. I think that's a big step forward.
All right.
But anybody I can help, they're welcome to reach out. I will do the best I can. I am by no means an expert, but I would help anybody kind of talk through what they're trying to do and ideas of how they can make those steps to get their protocols in place.
All right. Well, Susie, thank you so much. Appreciate
awesome.
It. Ready.
All righty.
Aloha.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was Susie Wilkinson of Susie's Duck Sanctuary. It had to destroy its flock after birds in the backyard operation here on Oahu tested positive for avian flu last year. On Friday, Maui County reported its first case of a duck with the virus, and in October, a duck in Manoa was the first positive case this fall. Look for links on our website after the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Hey, Yo-Yo, remember when we went to that remote island in Hawaii?
Absolutely. Molokai. It is so different from all the other islands in Hawaii.
I'm Ana Gonzalez. I've been traveling with Yo-Yo Ma for the last few years.
I'm so grateful to be here.
And in Hawaii, we saw how a place can contain so many memories buried in the land.
Growing up, it was always like, oh, that's where they sent all the sick people.
Listen to Our Common Nature from WNYC wherever you get podcasts.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
This is a challenging time for all small businesses in Hawaii, and in some ways, especially for restaurants. Some of those issues go back to the time of the pandemic and the government response. One Hawaii restaurant is suing the state over a tax issue that they say is unfair. This comes as the industry faces many other challenges, including the impending raise in the state minimum wage from $14 to $16 at the beginning of 2026. HPR's Bill Dorman recently sat down with Monica Taguchi, the owner of the longtime family restaurant Highway Inn. They talked about what has led to this point.
When did you first realize that you're going to be on the hook for the GET?
Thanks, Bill, for having us. We received a restaurant revitalization fund back in 2021. We were still in the height of the pandemic. And then we had the Lahaina fires happen in 2023. And then subsequent to that, we received a tax bill from the State Department of Tax for about $40,000.
And that was something that you were not expecting because there were no GET to go with the PPP program, with the EIDL program, and yet there was on this. That was a surprise.
Correct. You know, back in 2020, the state tax department issued a TIR tax information release. And in that, the state tax department has a very wide net in regards to general excise tax. I think many of us know that they can pretty much tax GET on pretty much any sale or income. And so they recognized that the pandemic was so severe. And so for all those people that received PPP, EIDL, PUA, they clearly stated in this informational release that they would not have to pay general excise tax. The PPP was issued through banks. And so you would apply through your bank, and the banks would then issue. So there was, I would assume, some privilege in that relationships. If you had a good relationship with your bank, it had to be fair. But obviously, you know, you knew people that could help assist you in that process and that application process. When it came to Restaurant Revitalization Funds, RRF, that was issued directly through the Small Business Administration. So from a data standpoint, maybe about 7 or 8% of restaurateurs across the country received PPP. Not everybody was affected the same way, and yet they received PPP. If you're a real estate company, for example, if you remember the bidding wars that happened through the pandemic.
But clearly, restaurants in a different situation and in a tougher spot. A lot of those minority-owned, a lot of those women-owned. So it's a different story.
Yeah. So Congress then subsequently recognizing this disparity had put aside $25 billion, $26 billion appropriated specifically for the restaurants. What they also recognized is that women, ethnic minorities, and veterans also, or minority groups, did not get federal pandemic monies. And so on top of the restaurant suffering or hospitality industry suffering, minority groups were also impacted greatly. And so what they allowed minority groups such as myself to do is they gave us several days of a head start to apply for these funds. Mm-hmm. Now, in all these pandemic monies, the need was far, far greater than the amount of money that was available. So I'm sure like within a day or so or two, this money was snatched up. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the data does show that more minority groups were awarded under the RRF. And so what Congress had intended in terms of balancing the disparity of who received federal pandemic monies, they achieved that through the RRF. And that was really, quite frankly, a lifeline for so many restaurants. So, you know, what I find very difficult to digest is the fact that the industry that clearly suffered the most is now being required to pay general excise tax, while other industries that received PPP did not have to.
Now, the legislature weighed in on this. Among other committees, House Ways and Means Committee voted 13-0 to reverse this tax, basically, on restaurant owners. What's your take on what happened to that?
That's a great question. And I think this is, you know, the challenges from a political standpoint, how things can be very challenging is that we went to the state legislature in an attempt to, if the state tax department basically continued to pursue taxing restaurants, then we thought our state legislators would be able to support this bill. And they did. So it passed, you know, several committees. It passed unanimously the Ways and Means Committee. And then when it got to the Finance Committee, then Finance Chair Kyle Yamashita did not hear the bill. And for many people, and including myself, who have provided testimony at the state legislature many times, sometimes you just don't know how this works. And I was not aware that a chairperson of a committee could single-handedly kill a bill.
That's part of the power of the legislature.
Correct.
How that works. So the legislative route did not work, which took you to negotiations with the Department of Taxation. Now you're in this legal situation. So the case has been heard, and now you're going to be waiting to hear what they
Correct.
Say on the case.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of these things, whether, you know, it's unemployment or it's taxes, we have these state agencies where you can, you know, argue your case internally administratively. And if you don't like the reply, you can go and appeal administratively. And once you exhaust that process, then you really have no choice after that to take, you know, and it's pretty intimidating to take a state agency like the state tax department and hold them, you know, basically accountable. But I believe that, you know, this action is highly unjust. I do believe that every state agency, when it comes to policy making, it should not be arbitrary. It should be consistent. And definitely it should not be discriminatory.
So if you could have the proverbial magic wand to make a policy change to adjust something to make things better for small business in Hawaii, what might that be?
Oh, gosh, that's such a complicated, loaded question. You know, there's, from a tax standpoint, for example, we pay one of the highest taxes in the country on top of highest real estate, on top of highest goods. It is, from a policy standpoint and regulatory standpoint, we have a lot of regulations to comply with as well. And so we're constantly ranked as one of the worst places to do business in the country, on top of our energy prices, on top of our real estate prices, on top of our minimum wage. And, you know, it's not that we are against minimum wage, but we have tried for several years to help our legislators understand the meaning of tip credit. Because as a company, it's our back of house staff that really suffers. It's not
those dishwashers,
correct,
and the people
dishwashers
working in the kitchen.
Right. Line cooks that have to learn their skill and trade for years. You know, you could just hire somebody pretty quickly and teach them how to be a server if they're articulate. And but the wage disparity, because of the minimum wage, has gotten bigger, so people don't want to work in the back. They want to work in the front where they can make more money, and rightfully so.
Meanwhile, in terms of the folks in Hawaii working minimum wage jobs,
it's so tough. I mean, it's a struggle to find housing. It's a struggle to find basic needs. You know, even people, your own income tax, for example, right? And we our infrastructure, our roads, our airports, our public education, all these things require money, and we understand why we have taxes. I think as a business owner, it's always been a struggle for me to understand where all this money goes. If we are one of the highest taxed, you know, populations out there and we pay a lot of money, I'm not familiar with how our state spends its money.
Let me ask you this. Anything that you see that's hopeful, what encourages you? What helps you get up in the morning?
You know, it's the people. It's always going to be the people of Hawaii. I think we have such a unique culture here. Obviously, Highway Inn has been doing Hawaiian food for almost 80 years. We definitely, you know, going back to that question, see softening in Kaka'ako, where we rely more on tourism, and that's been quite affected. Waipahu has remained pretty stable. It's our local communities that really have supported us through the many years, and the reason why we're around for as long as we have been. But we have just this unique culture that relationships really do matter and people do really care. I think from a policy standpoint, from a tax standpoint, from a business regulatory standpoint, I definitely think we can do much, much better.
I've been talking with Monica Taguchi-Ryan of Highway Inn, family-owned Hawaii restaurant since 1947, about a series of challenges facing small businesses and particularly restaurants here in Hawaii. Thanks for being here.
Mahalo. Thanks for allowing me to be here.
That was HPR's Bill Dorman and Monica Taguchi, the owner of Highway Inn. We should note that Highway Inn has previously been an underwriter of HPR.
Support for HPR comes from Malama'ola Health Services on Oahu, offering individualized hospice and palliative care 24/7 to patients in their residence, nursing home, or other setting. 808-543-1188.
HPR is hiring a communications and digital marketing manager to oversee the effort to promote our station's statewide services on the air and across digital platforms. If you have marketing experience and consider yourself to be especially skilled on digital media, apply now to be a part of the team. For more information, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. Now on view, Lyrically Rebellious, the Prince of Onchi Koshido, a pioneer of abstract art in Japan. HonoluluMuseum.org.
For decades, Kauai's North Shore has been a learning desert. The Namahana School aims to change that. Kapua Chandler leads the new charter school. She recalls that her father and brothers took the bus from Wainiha. It's why she feels so excited to be in the position of fulfilling a wish the community has had for decades, longer than an hour commute for those living past Hanalei. She explains the challenges facing rural communities and the need being met by Namahana.
A big piece I think a lot of folks don't know is part of being on the beautiful North Shore, we've got a lot of single lane bridges, so they can only take one of the small buses down to everybody, bring them past Hanalei, bring everyone who lives in Haena to Hanalei. They all get off, then they get on a bigger bus, then they start to pick everybody else up. So that was a big thing, just youth developmentally waking up and having to wake up. So wake up in the dark and before they even get to school has been something that's happened since my dad's generation. And it still continues till today. And so then the other piece of that is, you know, when you look at, we have two elementary schools on our side, Kilauea and Hanalei elementary schools, and there's so much community involvement and so much parent involvement. And there's a big shift that happens for our youth once they go to middle school and high school and they have to commute to the east side. It really becomes challenging for families to stay engaged. There's also isn't a bus that comes back in the afternoon for athletes. So any extracurricular or pieces, things like that in the community at that time, it was really difficult as a young person to do that. And also our island bus doesn't even pass Hanalei. So even if you were to try to catch the county bus, there's just obstacles upon obstacles. But a lot of it is just about like our students and their rest and their well-being and then their ability to participate in school productively and extracurricular. And then also families being able to stay connected when they did go. It's what made Namahana and bringing a campus that's geographically located in our community is going to be such a huge, huge deal, especially when we get to our permanent campus in Kilauea, where we serve majority of our students. About like, it's between like 43 to 46% of our students all live in Kilauea in walking or biking distance from the school site.
And it really does seem like a success story being able to get this off the ground and open it up to students. But something that struck me is that you also receive funding from private foundations like the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. And I'm wondering what the strategy was and how you and your team outreached and presented yourselves to secure that funding.
Yeah, we're incredibly grateful and humbled by getting support from Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan. I got the opportunity to meet them, and they're just so down to earth and work with their team on helping to support community initiatives like Namahana School. I think there's a huge range to answer that question, but I think the short of it is the need speaks to itself. Anybody who's on the North Shore, who's involved in our community and is thinking about what happens to our youth after sixth grade knows about Namahana School. And the more we started to tell that story and share and outreach to community members, it's like bi-directional. Folks reach out to us and we reach out to others. But it is a pretty incredible story. It's like an undeniable need in a community that is so beautiful and so popular. And yet the inequity around education and access to education is pretty unbelievable. And I think that story really tells itself. Like, there isn't much you have to add to that once people like fall in love with this place, fall in love with our community, and then find out our kids are riding the bus 2 to 3 hours just to get to middle and high school. You know, you got 12-year-olds being shuttled. It's a big part of that. I think the big piece too is how much involvement that we used with community members in building the dream and our vision for the campus and the vision for the school. All those layers, I think, feed into our story and feed into how we share out with the general public, rally support, and vice versa. And so I think like that's been, I think, a big piece where we've gotten a lot of traction here on Kauai and just trying to share our story into broader and bigger communities.
What felt like some of the first big milestones? When was the moment that in your head you thought, okay, this is actually going to happen? This isn't just a pipe dream that generations have had at this point?
Oh, I think the biggest milestone at first was getting our charter. I think that took years, and you know, so many schools apply and don't get it and have to reapply. And the fact that we applied and got unanimous approval all the way through and had like so much support on all these layers, I think was a testament to how much the community believed in it. I mean, our governing board and the skills, the community members that came on and the skills and expertise that's on my governing board, I'm so blessed and our community is so blessed to have that level of expertise behind me and guiding me as we went into that process. I can remember the day that we pressed the button and submitted the application, and it was like, ah, and then we had to do interviews. We had to fly over to Oahu and meet with folks. You know, it was a really elaborate process, and to come out the other side and to actually get approval was huge. It was like a big exhale, but at the same time, you get conditional approval, and we had 2 years to open. And so then you really have a clock. You've got to figure out all the pieces, because now you've really got to get it open. But that, I think, was a huge moment. I think the next big milestone was securing our permanent campus in Kilauea. That was huge. Like, being able, I think it's one thing for it to be a theory and in our community's minds, and to be there at our land blessing, which we did exactly 1 year before our opening date. You know, we had hundreds of community members come out. We had our local kupuna who were playing music. We had a ceremony with youth from our community that were helping to lead it, and people got to bring whole kupu and lei and really gather the excitement about this dream that our community has had for years. But to like be in the place to see Namahana mountain range, like looking over our school, it was a beautiful and very emotional moment, I think, for our whole community. And then 365 days later, actually opening our doors, that would be like the next big one. On opening day, we had community members show up here at the school. They lined the road leading into our temporary campus, just waving in all the students. You know, students being like, not every student gets their first day of school. And it's like, what are all these people doing here? And sometimes they know and sometimes they don't know just how big of a deal this school and opportunity is in our community. And then after that, those community members, while we were here on campus with the staff and the students, all those community members went to our permanent campus. And we all did these like really cool drone photos. All the schools spelt out Namahana, and the community members made our Namahana N. But just trying to remember that while we're here in our temporary site, we really want to also be feeding into our permanent site as well, as that's where we're headed in the future. We're really excited about that.
Talk a little bit about how the semester is going. And my understanding is that you're planning on ramping up a little bit more. So currently you accept students in two grades. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So this year we opened with 7th and 8th. And then, as you described it, the ramping up is each year we're adding a grade. So next year we'll grow to 9th and then 10th and then 11th. Our first graduating class will be the class of 2030, which I think is really exciting for us. And that's when our school will be full. This quarter has been really exciting. Like a semester, if you think of the first quarter and the second quarter. First quarter, we really focused in on our OLA framework, which is our health framework. We're a school that's thinking about the health and wellness of our students and how are our students healthy? How is our school healthy? And that being the foundation. And this quarter, I think what's been really cool is we've launched our Ulu Aina, which is our field study site. So it's Wednesday today, and all of our students are not here at school. They're at the campus. They're all off campus at different community sites with community partners, community biologists and environmentalists and watershed managers, and really getting exposure to the potential careers and also getting connected to our land and our aina and our home. And a lot of that's what we're building right now in leading up to our high school model, where students will be off campus at internships and pursuing their own interests and passions. So it's really been exciting to see the dream, I think, come to life as we have a community with a lot of our youth that are so connected and so well-grounded in the skills outside of campus that you don't always get to see. And this type of model really brings the school into those spaces and then those spaces back to the school.
What are you hoping for the school? If in a few years you look back, what will you need to see to be able to feel for yourself that this was a success for you and the community?
I am so clear on this answer. It's definitely going to be more than a few years, but at the moment that we have a Namahana graduate alumni come back as a kumu for Namahana, I can retire. My work here is done.
Yes, that's your moment. They can take over. They can have your office.
It's just that imagining creating a school culture and a youth looking to who do I want to be and how do I want to give back to my community, and going and getting an education or a teaching degree and returning home and fulfilling that and giving back to your community in this space, for me would be like the ultimate sign that Namahana has been successful in that pipeline, is getting our youth really grounded in who they are in our community, and then being able to come back to our community, live here, work here, and feed the future leaders of our community. That really, for me, will be my exciting moment. Before then, I'll just really excited when we graduate our first student. That'll be another one. But the moment that a youth comes back, a Namahana alumni comes and decides to be a kumu here, I think that's going to be a pretty remarkable day for our school.
That was Kapua Chandler, principal of Namahana School on Kauai, which is open this fall. We'll continue to track the school's progress as it continues to grow. In this year, we celebrate the 125th anniversary of the arrival of Okinawans on Hawaii's plantations. We pause to reflect on the history of their music. Here to talk about it is HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, when I covered the Okinawan festival, you know, it was just very lovely to see the dances and to hear the music. So, yeah, what did you find in your research?
So in my reporting, I talked to two researchers at the University of Hawaii's Department of Earth Sciences, and they actually looked at classical Ryukyuan music from the past, from the 18th century, to kind of unlock what was the geological landscape and the climate in Okinawa 300 years ago. And this study was published in Geoscience Communication in October of this year, and they started the study back in 2022. And they found that not much has actually changed, because Okinawa is actually known for its earthquakes, its typhoons, and volcanic activity because it sits on a convergent plate boundary. And what that means, the convergent plate boundary, you have these two tectonic plates that are coming towards each other, which causes earthquakes and mountain ranges to form, and also the formation of volcanoes as well. And Justin Higa, he's the co-author of the study. He said the lyrics, which is from Nubui Kuduchi and Kudai Kuduchi, which are the two songs they looked at, those lyrics in the songs were very specific to what the sailors at the time they saw when they were sailing from Okinawa Island to the Kyushu Island.
There's this dependence on consistent seasonal winds, more specifically related to the monsoon season in East Asia. So, you know, if something breaks down in that climate system, for example, if climate change messes that up and that doesn't happen anymore, then those winds that are recorded in the song would disappear. Other things are a little more ambiguous, like certain areas of the sea between Okinawa and Kyushu Island were described as having really rough waves. And that's where we kind of speculated, oh, this could be because typhoons are really common in the area. Modern studies on wave height and wind speeds show some high areas in those regions that are specifically mentioned. That's also the location where a major ocean current crosses from the west to the east, perpendicular to the Ryukyu Island.
So much like Native Hawaiian culture, how they use mele to tell stories of the past, this is what the researchers also found. They found a parallel between Native Hawaiian culture and Okinawan culture by looking at their classical music to kind of tell stories of the past as well. And when you break down Nuboi Kuduchi and Kudai Kuduchi, Justin Higa, he said Nuboi means to go up, while Kudai means to go down, and Kuduchi is supposed to be this chronological order. So if you hear the song talks about how these sailors are sailing from, at the time, Ryukyu Islands, now known as Okinawa, to Kyushu Island in mainland Japan, and how sad they were. But also they talked about in the lyrics the rough waves that they were in, going through, and the sight of the volcano, which indicates that they finally made land after X amount of days that they've been in the ocean. And the researchers also found that there was also volcanic activity 300 years ago like there is today.
We have one point of information of activity today, one point of activity 300 years ago recorded in the song, and then the earliest recorded activity was from a Japanese story hundreds of years before this Okinawan song was ever written. So that's kind of like a 3 points of activity, kind of suggesting this volcano has been active for a long time, and agreeing with modern Western scientific methods of dating rocks and finding the age of eruptions to scientifically suggest that these volcanoes have been active for a long time.
So I also spoke with June Uye Uten, who's a co-author of the study. Both June and Justin, they are part of this dance group here in Hawaii, and they actually recently performed the song through singing and dance at a recent recital. And it was an all-women's recital and a debut performance that happened back in September in this all-female group. And June Uye Uten, she said that it was the first all-women performance outside of Okinawa.
We actually did the combination. It was the first time for us to perform it in this style, but it was also the two songs together were performed like intertwined with each other. Normally one song would be sung independently and the second song would be sung independently, but with our performance back, this is back on September 14th at our debut women's recital, we did the song intertwined. So we did both songs at the same time, telling the story of both journeys of the songs. But we can go into it a little bit more later. But that's true. Like Justin mentioned, it was the first time, it was an all-female performance, but it was also the first time that we did the combination of the two songs side by side at the same time, telling the stories of what his research did also share, you know. And that's the exciting part about this whole project. It just fell into place at the same time that this recital fell into place. And so that was maybe a very good coincidence, but it wasn't planned that way when we first started the research and the project itself.
Yeah, serendipity.
Exactly. And Justin really does hope that, you know, this the outcome of the research will also inspire them to look at more of like how nature was in Okinawa back then, but also the importance of using indigenous knowledge to uncover more of the past, whether it be the geological history or even just how people lived in Okinawa when it was known as the Ryukyu Islands.
Yeah, no, like I said, going to the festival, it was just so many different facets that I didn't know about, and you just have this deeper appreciation for the culture here.
Exactly, and through further reporting, just kind of looking about like how Okinawa sits in this plate boundary, we know about these natural disasters, but researchers, they do kind of want to use these songs to kind of uncover more stories of the past as well. So it was really interesting to kind of hear the songs, Nuboi Kudushi and Kudai Kuduchi. They're about 4 minutes long. This is also in their research, just looking at the 18th century and how it was. There were rough waves because of the typhoons and the trade winds from going from west to east as well. So Justin's hoping to study more of this in the future.
Yeah, hopefully you'll get to hear more of that in the community. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's culture and arts reporter, Cassie Ordonio. Find your stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ferraro Choi, architects for the HTDC Entrepreneur Sandbox in Kaka'ako, committed to design that serves and celebrates the environment, culture, and community. FerraroChoi.com.
Album of the Year winning Hawaii artists Kala'e and Kalana Parrish are bringing their island country style music to our Live from the Atherton Celebrate 808 concert series. Join us on Saturday, November 22nd, for an evening of music inspired by Hawaii's beautiful countryside. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
You know, earlier this month, HPR was out at Kehi Lagoon for the launching of a historic koa canoe. It was a daybreak on a calm morning that hundreds gathered to pay homage to paddling, past and future. Sarah Kuiva is the curator for the Bishop Museum, which owns the canoe. She shared the backstory of how it came to be. Some call it the a'a or a'a, the definitions to challenge, to dare, capture its voyaging spirit.
The Dowsett Ohana and the Perry Ohana have been helping Bishop Museum take care of this canoe, especially at key times when it needed a lot of care. And in really interactive and energetic conversations over the past 3 years, we decided that it was time to put it back in the water the first time in over 12 years. And as a way to celebrate the art of Kalaiva'a and the continued care and restoration of the koa canoes that we still know and love today. So the A was commissioned by Prince Kuhio in 1901 and completed in 1902 in Kailua Kona on Hawaii Island. It was built by Henry Weeks and Anton Grace, who are very well-known woodworkers and koa canoe makers. And when it moved to Oahu, its Kailua Kona crew came with it, and it started racing against the Oahu-based teams and really started winning in these really amazing competitive races. And because the A was so successful in the water, it led a lot of other canoe clubs to start making custom canoes. And the A is considered to be the canoe that started it all and in terms of outrigger competitive racing. And all the koa canoes that we have here with us today too came from it. And so it's a really amazing, almost family reunion of sorts.
Also on the beach that day, master canoe builders Tay Perry and Jay Dowsett, they came out the night before the launch to see the koa canoes lined up on the beach. Perry said it was like greeting their grandchildren because they had a hand in their lives.
I spent hours, blood, sweat, and tears on that many, about half of the boats that we were looking at yesterday. And some was minor and some was major. But I know the boats all pretty clearly. Spent time with them. And yeah, it's like old home week, walking there. Even now, I like to walk by and give them a pat.
Because these canoes are in the hands of our clubs, and that was the whole idea.
They're being used, they're being raced. If it weren't for the Canoe Racing Association, Hawaiian Canoe, there would not be koa canoes. Everything would be fiberglass or composites. But these boats are special. The sport of paddling in whatever kind of canoe you paddle will keep the canoe sport alive. As far as koa canoes are concerned, if it weren't for the Hawaiian Canoe Racing Association and its canoe rules, there would be half as many koa canoes in existence today. So to me, that's important. And the source, the supply of koa canoes is very limited, because you have to destroy $100,000 worth of tree to make a $50,000 boat, not counting the labor. And so the cost of the wood is very expensive, and it's a prize for furniture and a lot of other things that koa is used for. And koa only grows in Hawaii, and mostly on the Big Island, and so not a limitless supply.
But that makes this day all the more special when you think about that.
I think so, yeah. Oh yeah, this day and this particular canoe with all its friends and other canoes make a spectacle that no one can see anywhere else.
For Perry, the event was an emotional one, full of pride and memories.
So that canoe out there is 127 years old. As such, it's the oldest racing canoe in Hawaii. Nobody's currently racing it, but it could race. It's a little heavier than most of the other boats, but I personally have a strong bond with that canoe because it's one of the most perfect Hawaiian canoes that I've been associated with. Anyway, without the Dowsett family, the canoe would not exist today. Their grandfather back in 1952 or 53 got the canoe, which was in a total state of ruin. There were cracks the whole length of it. The gunwales were all broken and termite eaten, and the hull was just literally falling apart. And my father, George Perry, was commissioned by Herb Dowsett, and together they put together what you see now, the rebirth of it. And Bishop, I think during the time, the Dowsetts are smarter on this than I am, but I think at the time the canoe was the property of Bishop Museum, because it was donated to them. And the Dowsetts were allowed a free hand to restore it, which they did. And they continue to do work on it and restore it up to the present time. So I just underwent a minor upgrade in terms of making the canoe wide enough so that some people could fit in the seats, and to clear up some termite damage and some other cracks that are occurring. To me, it's amazing that canoe exists today and it looks as good as it does today. And incidentally, it was the first koa canoe I ever did work on. I, as a 13-year-old kid, was able to do little more than do sanding at the instruction of my father and his other staff. But anyway, that was the rebirth of the A'a from oblivion.
And that was a moment in time out on the water for the relaunch of Prince Kuhio's Koa Canoe, which was Lanikai Canoe Club's first koa canoe and the start of its storied paddling history. Look for more pictures from the event on our website later today. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow we hear about how artificial intelligence is seeping into our lives. Have an AI story to share? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find The Conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.